Hello and welcome to episode 123 of the Creighton Crowbar. It is the, what day is it?
14th of December
2015, and this is our last episode of the year. My name is Chris Thurston and I'm joined by Graham Smith.
Hello.
Marsh Davies.
Hello.
Tom Senior.
Hello.
And Tom Francis. Hello. And if you're watching this on YouTube, you may notice something slightly different about the video we've uploaded to this episode, in that it is a video and not just a picture of a box.
Just been our traditional approach.
Yeah, so we are here, not live, pre-recorded from Tom Francis' living room to talk for X amount of time about 2015 in computer games.
The best ones.
The best ones, yeah.
Like, we should note that we're all being played by actors for this particular episode of the podcast, I hope the performances are excellent and do us justice.
We managed to find five identical beards. And Tom.
This isn't Tom's house, this is a set. It's nothing, none of it is real. Anyway.
It's all lies. Anyway, what isn't lies is our opinions on computer games from this year that we're going to have. So we're going to diverge from the traditional format somewhat and just talk about...
A massive list.
So we were planning to get all of us to choose a game of the year and maybe a couple of runners-up and then go through them one by one, person by person. However, that's... we didn't. So... instead of doing that, what we're going to do is go through the entire long list of games that we all liked, and by the end of the episode,
we'll maybe, definitely have an idea.
Definitely, we will have each chosen a game to give a meaningless accolade to.
We'll see you in 5 hours. Approximately.
What are we drinking, Tom? I feel like we should explain everything we're doing, because they can see us now.
These are vanilla peach old fashions.
Good God. They're very nice.
Made with vanilla sugar, which is vanilla and sugar in a blender, and peach bitters, and unexpectedly good.
Yeah, it's been really
yes.
Nice.
You're supposed to use orange bitters, but apparently peach works.
You have to drink on YouTube, aren't you?
I assume so. Well, there's My Drunk Kitchen, which is like...
Right, yeah, you can't drink on Twitch, that's what I'm thinking of.
Really?
Yeah, you can't, you can drink, you're not able to be drunk on Twitch.
Interesting.
They're
weirdly sanctimonious in some ways.
Yeah, given the things that they permit in chat. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I guess if anyone asks any questions, it's iced tea and tasty, sharp
as long as iced tea. The drink. And Daddy's a little bit tired. All right, Marty is going to lead us down the long list that we assembled 30 seconds ago and is written in pencil.
Mugsver. How do people feel about Mugsver, otherwise known as Metal Gear Solid 5, The Phantom Pain?
It's good.
I like it. Next.
Just in case it was going to pass over in silence. It's really good. It's. I don't know if it's my game of the year yet. We'll find out at the end of the podcast.
I enjoyed it probably more at points than any other game of the year, but then there were huge parts of it that I really intensely hate.
Yeah.
And I didn't finish it either, so I kind of feel guilty picking it.
There are the vast majority of it I really loved of my time with it, which was, you know, like 40 hours or something, and about 4 of those hours were spent in the kind of bullshitty scripted missions where things were happening beyond my control and I wasn't given any ability to foresee or plan around the things. And then there's just awful scripted sequences, and then obviously the story itself, everything I saw of it, I hated. Not that I gave it a chance, I was skipping cutscenes right from the start. But I was still surprised at how much of it was just let me be in the open world and just let me tackle things with my own accord. Obviously, you kind of get to decide that yourself by whether you take on the main missions or the side missions. But even within the main missions, like, probably 7 out of 10 of them were just open-ended, really cool things. There were even some that kind of had scripting in them, but the scripting was really, like, sophisticatedly done, like, really well thought through and could adapt to anything you did with it. One where... your target is going to visit a series of prisoners around in like 3 different camps across the open world and do 3 different interrogations.
Oh, yeah.
And one of them is your target, but you can't find out, you don't know where any of them are to begin with, so you have to tail the interrogator to find all 3 and scope out all 3, and then when you see the right one, it'll be flagged up as the right one and you can rescue him. And it's not, like, it's randomized rather than pre-scripted which one it is, so it could be the first one you see, I think. And also, all of them still exist out in the open world before you even start. And not only that, but they are the wrong locations for the interrogations. So while this is all going on, you're tailing the guy, they're being driven to their respective locations. So you can happen across them just being driven along the road and just like spy them and go, oh, hang on, that's my target. And then just run in and take it. And that was, I did that like 4 or 5 times, and everything I tried to put a spanner in the works, it just adapted seamlessly and just everything made perfect sense. And some of those playthroughs were like the wrong ones and ended up being like impossible or frustrating, but other ones were, you know, felt great to kind of refine a strategy, but then also cope with the randomness of it. And it was weird to see, because in the same game, the things I hate are scripted missions where they scripted things just to, it has to unfold this way because this is the plot, you know, these at this point these people show up and they scupper your mission in this way, and at the when the cutscene ends you're in front of all these people, so if you want to do a stealth approach, fuck you, too late. And yet in the same game they have these amazingly like flexible scripted systems that feel like you would, I expect to only see that in a game where the developers have decided ahead of time, like, we have to respect what the player wants to do and we'll never, you know, take control away from him, we'll never determine what kind of playstyle he wants to do. But this game just has all types of all things.
It feels like, at times, like there is a way that the game wants you to play it, or a preferred way to do certain missions. Like, it has these resource systems in the meta game where you're building up your oil rig army, and it has scoring at the end of missions, which is quite good at favouring whether you want to play lethally or not. But it's still... like the resource thing incentivizes going in close to mission objectives, because then you can stick balloons on more stuff and steal them for your base back home. But because they're using that to incentivize you, it seems like there are missions where the two guys are meeting up inside a building and then they're going to walk off to a helicopter, and, you know, there's an incentive to sneak in there, make your way past 2 dozen guards, take them out silently or kidnap them or whatever. But you can also just go to a nearby hill and shoot a rocket launcher from like 300 yards away that just blows up both of them and then just run away. And the mission success, the game's completely okay with that.
Yeah. Even in the more scripted bits, I mean, specifically the bullshit stuff is with those kind of ghost commando things.
Oh, yeah. Skulls.
The skulls. Whenever they show up, it just, the game goes to shit immediately. Like, it immediately becomes really bad. But whenever that's not happening, it's amazing how fluid it is. Even in supposedly scripted missions, like, you could do something else, like get to a guy before I was supposed to, and you know, he was supposed to be whisked away to a base in a car, but I just knocked everyone out and he never got in the car. And it was fine because the mission wanted me to tail him to the base, but instead I interrogated him and then he told me where the base was. So there's always this kind of layers of kind of failure where the scripting will break down but give you a way to continue in a way that feels really natural in the world, which is pretty exceptional.
The skulls are total bullshit, but the first, like, 3 times I encountered them, I just ran away. I just got on my horse and fucked off. And, and after a certain distance, the game was just like, all right, you're done with that challenge, I guess. And then the first mission, as a result, the first mission that the skulls don't turn up at the end, they turn up partway through, is like a twist reveal, and you actually have to deal with them because you haven't yet extracted your target. That was then a huge pain in the ass, even more so, because I didn't know, I'd never fought them before, and I was like 30 hours into the game. And so I went, someone linked, I think maybe you, Tom, someone on Twitter posting, this mission is bullshit, here's a YouTube video for how to do it. And it's basically just a particular fence that, sorry, if you just climb over that fence, you can just stick a balloon on the truck that you're trying to extract, and the skulls still turn up, but because you are so close to the truck at the point where you just climb over this fence, that, you know, you just get it out and then you just climb back over that fence and just skip it.
That mission is one that I was warned was bullshit, and when I started it I'm like, I can't, because it has a name, so you know it's that mission. And
Traitor's Caravan, I think it is.
Yeah. And I think Andy Kelly had said it was fucking awful. And I started, you've got to intercept a convoy. And I was like, 5 minutes in, I'm like, I'm already having a great time setting up this ambush. I've got my horse to shit on the road. I've got my horse also to stand in the road. And then I've parked several cars in the road. And I've planted C4 all over the place. And I'm like, this is going to be amazing. And the convoy shows up, without spoiling anything. It's not amazing. And fuck you if you had any kind of plan. And so, yeah, I didn't even... let myself get frustrated by repeating it. It was such bullshit from the very first time. I'm like, I'm never going to enjoy this. I need to just have someone tell me exactly how you do it. And of course on YouTube there's like, here's how to get the maximum possible rating on the maximum possible difficulty with all the possible handicaps. And it involves just, I don't even fire a shot, you just run in a straight line, there's a particular point and pull through the fence and your balloon's there before they in other situations they'll shoot down the balloon. Sometimes that's the rule, like, you can't Fulton it, you've got to deal with the threat, because otherwise they'll shoot down the Fulton balloon. But then nope, if you just do it at a certain time it's fine.
Yeah, because in that situation they do shoot down the Fulton balloon. I think that's the problem with that mission, is it's not so much that it throws the skulls at you, although they are bad, it's that it counters your bollocks magical mechanic, which is your magical failsafe balloon that steals things, with their bullshit magic mechanic, which is leaping zombie men that fly out of places and don't die. So that feels unfair at that point, because you're used to having all of the power and you're used to being able to determine basically what the rules are for who can do what and when.
I think you're going to sum up the Metal Gear Solid series in three words. It would be bullshit magical mechanic. And I was kind of thankful that that took a massive backseat in this game, and it's such a strangely different game from every other Metal Gear Solid game. And it's crazy that, you know, it actually becomes this open world, beautiful, systemic game, when always previously it's been really loads of interesting systems in it, but really, really quite linear to most parts.
There was a surprising number of people who wrote features and reviews about the game that said, "Oh, this is the game Kojima's been trying to make all along." And they said,
"No, that's not true."
I think the
only way you can argue that is that he went through a sort of process of evolution himself, where he went from literally, like, because obviously Kojima being into movies is the thing everybody says about Kojima. But the thing about Metal Gear Solid 5 is it does produce all these really cinematic moments, but it produces them usually dynamically. And that's, so if you argue that it is still a big action movie of a thing, but they've managed to engineer lots of ways to make the player in charge of the nature of that film and the kind of spectacle that follows, then I think you can argue that it's an evolution of what he's done before. But also, nah.
I guess it's kind of incomplete on PC at the moment, because the online component isn't out until January, I think. So that's going to be a whole thing.
Is that already out on consoles?
Yeah. You can wear a kitten on your head and kill people.
Yeah. So it could get better.
I saw trailers for it that look quite interesting.
Yeah.
Konami going to support that, though? Oh, well, there you go.
I can shrug now.
Yeah.
for a tiny percentage of our listeners.
Tom shrugs.
Are we done with Metal Gear Solid then?
It's good and I like it, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing.
How about Invisiblink?
Invisiblink.
Man, we're getting through all of my favourites. Because that's my other contender for Game of the Year. And it's definitely one of those two, but I haven't decided which yet.
This list is in the order that we thought of them in.
Yeah,
which is maybe indicative of the ones that we like most.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fucking great. I've played it before this year because it was in the IGF and I was judging it. Usually, it was only early access, so like anyone could play it at that point. And usually I stay away from it, but because it was in the IGF, I played it at an early stage. And so I did a playthrough of it quite recently. It's like a rare game where I played it before release, at release, and since release. And I was still discovering loads of new things about how the balancing works and what items are available. Actually, they kind of patched it recently, so that was all new as well. And I feel like I've had sort of three games worth of great experiences with it. You know, each campaign is about 8 hours, and I certainly played through, I think, twice before release, and then I think once or twice at release, and then once recently with a new DLC. And every time, it's been this... Not every campaign I've started, but every campaign I've continued with has been like a brilliantly gripping thing all the way through, and I've got so excited about it. And the thing it has over Metal Gear, like both of them, despite being incredibly different in terms of like presentation and format and stuff, it's a turn-based isometric strategy game about stealth. It's still kind of, I feel like it ticks a lot of the same boxes in terms of letting me play how I want and set up strategies and plan ahead and watch guard patrols and say, okay, I'm going to deal with this in this way. But the thing that Invisiblink has over Metal Gear for me is that one of them is that it's the way you build your team by buying equipment, upgrading your hacking AI, installing cybernetic implants and leveling up their skills. All those systems tie into each other really, really well. They're all really well thought through. The upgrades you can get are just sort of massively exciting. I can't think of another game where, like, when I go to a shop in Invisiblink, like, very rarely, if I'm far into the game and I've got loads of good stuff, it won't have anything that's massively exciting to me. But most of the time, particularly early on, you go to a shop and you're just like, oh my god, I can't believe that's like a dart gun that goes through two layers of armor and it replenishes every mission, but it's 1,200 and I'm going to have to sell my cat to do this. And even once you kind of do have some decent equipment, sometimes you... Like, you go to a shop and you realize, oh, fuck, well, like, we've already got a Buster chip that can hack a device for free if we get there in person, and that's on sale here. And so in another game that I'd be like, oh, well, you can't have two because it's some special bullshit rule, but Invisible Link, no, if you've got two, then you can just do that twice. And they've got cooldowns of, like, four turns each, but they're separate, so you can do one and then you can do another. and I ended up with a character with like 5 Buster Chips. Just the whole inventory was just Buster Chips. And so you just run up to anything, and no matter how absurdly difficult it was to hack, she could do it for free, basically. And then by the time we needed to do that again, at least one of them would be recharged. And for most of the game, you don't need anything like that. I wouldn't use them on most missions because I already had a pretty good hacking setup as well. And then right on a sort of critical mission, they sometimes throw in like total curveballs where it's just like, oh, you thought you had armor piercing. Well, this guy needs 8 armor piercing. And there was a guy who had 12 shields, which means basically 12 armor piercing. So armor piercing, you're like, you get 1 early on and you can maybe level up to like 2, and then if you stack loads of mods and cybernetic orgs, you might get up to like 4. So piercing more than 4 layers of armor in the conventional campaign is just absurd. But if they're shields, you can also hack them. Like, each one is a firewall as well as being a layer of armor, so the more you can hack, the less armor penetration you need. And because I had this one character who just had 5 Buster Chips, she could just sneak up to this guy and just go and you had no armor.
I feel like it's the designer's game on the list.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Every system it's got feels so tightly wound and so tightly underwoven that there's nothing wasted in the game. It's precision engineered to create these tense little scenarios.
Does this amazing thing of being a turn-based tactical game with no element of chance in it beyond the initial random generation of the levels. So you always know where the guard sightlines are. You always know where the cameras are. You always know exactly what all their capabilities are, like what their shields are. Everything is listed for you. And even then, it's an amazing, like, consistently interesting challenge, which is extraordinary. I can't think of another game that is like that.
Yeah.
I mean, XCOM is amazing, but it's incredibly, all of its tension comes from chance.
Yeah.
Whereas this is a game that all the tension comes straight from design, and it's all just pure design, and always works. It's amazing.
This year I've been really interested in games that are that transparent with the player, that really don't hide very much from you.
Yeah.
Like, it has Fog of War, but it gives you complete control over how and when you get rid of that Fog of War. And
also you can see the vision cones of people who you don't know about.
Yeah.
So if you can see a square and it says it's clear, it is clear for sure. You don't have to worry about anything.
Exactly. It feels completely fair. So it allows you to own all your mistakes. And I think that's really crucial. Like, coming from a lot of games, including something I really like this year that's actually not on the list, I think maybe even should be, which is StarCraft Legacy of the Void. Although actually, I might leave that one off because it's StarCraft 2 and everyone knows what that is. But you know, StarCraft 2 is a lot about, even in single player or in multiplayer, it's about an element of chance, in that there's a lot of chance involved in not seeing things. There's a lot of chance involved in missing game elements, even though ultimately it's kind of like a deterministic mathematical formula that you're resolving either successfully or unsuccessfully. Whereas Invisible Ink, it still feels like an improvisation, even though everything's completely clear. Because you're always given complete control over what information you get and when, and you, as you say, you always know exactly what the consequences of an action are going to be when you perform them. And that's it feels like a magic trick, like, to making something that precise.
I love having fewer characters, a greater concentration of power, which is what I enjoy about things like Dawn of War 2, where it's not about lots of individual drones that you kind of corral. It's about these individual powerful things that you can direct very with great intention, and that makes your decisions more meaningful, because it's not like, I'm going to vaguely move these dudes over there and maybe some of them will be successful, maybe some of them won't. It's like every single action you do is it comes straight from you, and there's no kind of layer of interpretation there. So there's no people getting stuck on scenery. There's no kind of, you know, this form of things isn't going to betray your intention. It's always, you've got this one agent and they're going to do the thing you tell them to do, and you're playing the game completely directly. There's nothing between you and the consequences of your decisions. It's really, really good.
I was going to say, why aren't more games like that? And I suspect it's because it's hard.
Yeah. I've listened to some podcasts with those guys talking about the process of designing it, and it was hard. it sounds like went through massive revisions of so many times. And actually, it's interesting. I think it did well. I don't know anything about the sales figures or anything, but it's like, it's got a great positive rating on Steam. But I talked before about how it, like, the fact that it has a pre-written narrative that has a kind of twist at the end clashes badly with the idea that it's a game you replay. And so it gets complaints about it being too short, when really it's a game that's like Spelunky, where its length is kind of irrelevant because it's about replaying it. But then there was also a thing where a lot of people just really can't get on with it at all because of the alarm system, which is, when you start a mission in Invisible Ink, there's an alarm that's just ticking up all the time. There's never, the individual guards don't know you're there, but the corporation do. Like, they know that there's someone in the building, and the longer you're in the building, the more security measures they'll bring online. And you can, some things that you do will increase the alarm rating faster, but even if you stay in just a tiny closet and never spotted by any guard at all, it will just keep going up every single turn. You're always, it's always getting worse and worse and worse. So even though it's time, even though it's turn-based, some people think of it as a game with a time limit, that there's just time pressure from the word go. And if it was real time, like, a, you know, if it was Splinter Cell and every mission had a real time time limit, that would be horrible. I'd hate it. And I see that reaction from people in it, because they just, they feel there's something about it being a stealth game that just tells them, well, then until I'm detected, nothing should be, there should be no pressure. And for me, I think it's not that I actually do have a negative reaction to that instinctively. Like, I do feel stressed out by it, and I want to say, oh, you should take that out because then I can strategize and, you know, plan around things. But I also, because I understand why the game works long term, because I've been through it so many times and seen why it needs that pressure, I'm appreciative of, like, no, this has to be there. If you take that out, it just becomes, your best strategy becomes a really boring one. You have to be pressured to move on, and you have to be pressured to kind of...
There's an interesting comparison with Metal Gear there, I think. Like, I think one of the problems stealth games face a lot is the moment when you're detected is sort of like the ultimate failure for a lot of players, which is where you get saves coming from in Thief or Deus Ex or whatever, because everyone really wants to ghost it. And the problem those games traditionally have is, how do you get players to keep going with an accident? Because that's when the interesting things happen, is when it's like, I was slightly detected, but I got away, or it went to shit, but I managed to improvise a solution. And all those systems go to waste if players are like, no, got, you know, smelled by a guard, I'm out. Like, you, Invisible Ink solves it by basically saying that just by entering the building, that initial detection has already taken place. The corporation has detected you coming in. They know you're there somewhere. Go, sort it out. And that's fine. You can still be vulnerable in that scenario, but it basically begins at the point where most people would already have quick-loaded a different stealth game. In Metal Gear, they just established that you're so powerful and you have so many options that getting detected is just a change in the plan, really. As long as it can be part of the plan. So even though there is, you know, if you're going for certain ratings, it's a good idea to try and ace everything and get a perfect stealth playthrough. When it doesn't, it's not the sort of shutting down of your options that happen in other stealth games. It's this big expansion. So therefore, the distinction between the two is a lot lighter than it is in other stealth games anyway. You have, you know, when you get detected in Metal Gear, it's suddenly headshot in time, or, like, I don't know, panic dog attack time. Or the best example of this is when, if you have Quiet with you in Metal Gear, before you get the upgrade that means she's not lethal, because you have to upgrade her to get her to stop fucking killing people, where she will just shoot anybody the moment they see you, regardless of whether you want her to or not, which adds a really interesting dynamic to that game, where it's like, oh, I guess we're killing people now.
Even the people you're there to extract or save. It feels like it's also a triumph of early access, because I mean, it's that thing you just said about it being hard to develop, and hearing Clay talk about it and the challenges of that. But I played just before it got added to early access, when Clay put it out to their own community, so you could buy it through their site, but you couldn't get it through Steam yet. And they sent that version out to press, and I didn't think it was very good. I think I talked about it on the podcast at the time, and it was, this might be good, but there's only two agents, and it feels kind of hollow at its core when it doesn't have that many agents and items, and it's so incredibly difficult as well that I just couldn't get past, like, the second or third level. And the generation of the levels, I don't think, was the final algorithm they settled on, so the way it would place level exits and that sort of stuff wasn't as finely tuned or as interesting as what they ended up with. So it feels like Clay knew where they were going, but only through early access worked out how they were going to get there. And there's not very many games in early access that I think have done as good a job of going through that process, updating regularly, and coming out as a much better game.
You know, Clay on a roll at the moment. They've done loads of amazing games in completely different genres.
Yeah,
yeah, it's really impressive.
I can't wait to see what they make next.
The next game is Rocket L, where L stands for League.
Thanks, Martin.
I like this game.
I also like this game.
I'm really, really bad at it. I think out of all the games on this list, it's the one game I really wish I was better at. Because I'm so incompetent, and yet it's just so tactile and pleasurable to be in that game. And very frustrating that I can't be as useful to my teammates.
It's been amazing watching people like Andy Kelly from work or Sam Roberts from PC Gamer as well go through some of the cycles of anger and despondency that comes with seriously getting into a competitive game. Yeah. These are people who I would never have thought would really seriously invest in a competitive thing. Like, I got them to try Dota and that was never going to stick. And they've sort of like looked at me weirdly when I've talked about the emotions that I've gone through competing in a thing. Things that you discovered through HOTS, which we'll talk about later, but like I've seen Sam sort of like boiling with rage at the inadequacies of whoever he's matched with and go through the terror of Elo hell and all the rest of this stuff. He's stuck in the trench because no one else is as good as him and all the rest of it. And that's been, it's been really vindicating. That's certainly the only reason that game is good. but actually it's almost a testament to the fact that it is good, that it's drawn people who would never have normally competed in a game in that way into this kind of like hardcore world of car football hockey.
It's getting people to play a football game. Yeah. The FIFA range.
Yeah, exactly.
In the office of the FIFA game.
It's been a really good year for extremely small games that know exactly what they are. Unusual this year. Like, I was going to mention Broforce later, just literally to mention it. But I mean, I think obviously they're quite dissimilar in every way, but apart from the fact that they are both, they just know themselves really well. They know exactly the kind of experience they want to give, and they're perfectly made with that in mind.
Rocket League is a sequel, right?
Yes, it is.
A previous game called like Rocket Fuel Powered Acrobatic Cars.
Something like Super Powered Acrobatic Rocket Cars or something like that, yeah, for the PlayStation 3. Didn't come on PC, and this is the first time it has. But yeah, it's like, it's a brilliant idea to the extent that you couldn't, people call it Cars plus Football, but it doesn't really feel like two things. It feels like Rocket League. It feels like Rocket League is a distinct sport that happens to involve cars and balls, but somehow works, for me, at least, better than either driving games or football games, because of the combination of things. And it's gotten really good as well. That's worth pointing out. So we talked about it a lot when it came out, but the recent updates they've done have been really, really good, partly at making the game, because it got quite hardcore. Like, I started playing it between Dota games with friends, and then it became the thing, we all getting really into it and playing it on multiple platforms and stuff, and worrying constantly about, you know, trying to get better at doing aerials and that kind of thing. Then they added all these mutators, so you can queue for a game that has random modifications, like a big square ball, or like a huge ball that barely fits in the goal, but has really, really high gravity, so it's ping-ponging around, no one fucking scores for 5 minutes, because no one can actually get it to fit. Like, and that sort of thing sort of makes it fun again, and makes it more like the old days of Rocket League. So, compared to a lot of competitive games, they've done a really good job of making it not kind of collapse in on itself.
Yeah, it's true, actually.
Under the weight of the ability of the player base.
I mean, most competitive games now kind of slowly migrate towards esport, basically, and to the high ends of play. But I think Rocket League has done a very good job of preserving, basically, noob play for scrubs. It's a good scrub game.
It's because it's also a bit like Gang Beasts.
Yeah.
Which maybe should be on this list.
Shit. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's not out yet.
It's still in early access. Thank
Came
God.
Came out in early access last year. Yeah. So it's,
wow.
It's
definitely not out yet.
Skipped a whole year from the original release to final release.
I mean, Gang Beasts is more slapstick, but Rocket League has that on slapstick to it. It's not Invisible Ink, which maybe goes without saying. But now I want to play a stealth game.
A lot of
game.
People think it is, but
now I want to play a stealth game where you have to get a really unwieldy beach ball through and like a cyberpunk mega corporation's office.
There are some like turn-based games. I think you talked before about like a turn-based chariot racing game. Turn-based games in action-based genres are really funny to me. There's a shoot 'em up that is maybe it's not turn based, maybe it's more like pause based, but it's a sort of really hectic spaceship top down shoot 'em up. And when you pause time, or maybe at the end of your turn or whatever, it shows arcs of where everything's going to go, and you create like gravity wells to try and curve people's bullets around.
What?
And so you see visualizations.
Wow, sounds awesome.
Be great if you can remember.
Now you're going to ask me what it's called. I can't remember.
It took me a moment, but the chariot racing game is called Quadriga. Fucking great.
Blood Bowl as well. It's a little turn-based silly sports game.
Yeah.
Well, one thing I love about Rocket League finally is that you literally, you are only ever 10 seconds away from a game of Rocket League if you're at your PC.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The match rate, the speed of it is so, that's hard to underrate how good that is.
Yeah, I think that's the reason it did get it hooked into me. I haven't really stuck with it like lately, but I played it a lot and I'll probably go back to it eventually, and it's largely because the rounds are so short, and most competitive games I bounce off because I don't like losing, and I'm not good at winning. And that's true of Rocket League as well, but it's only like 3 minutes or something, and then the next round's happening, and you can, you know, just quit out and get a different match if you're totally outclassed. Often I do play through because it's kind of interesting, because almost always my partner will quit. I play like 2v2 or 3v3, and usually my partner will quit because we failed and we suck. They probably noticed that I sucked in particular, but it's fun to try and like to take it back.
Best noises made by a human. In the noises you everybody makes when you play Rocket League. Extraordinary.
Yeah. I didn't think I was capable of hooting like the proles who used to play the football games in the PC game. And yeah.
It's made Martin less classist, and if anything.
No, it hasn't.
That would have been an achievement too far for any game.
No, it's true, actually. I think I'm no stranger to frustration with failure, but Rocket League is one of the few games where when I win, I'm a real fucking jerk.
Yeah,
I say all like, the jerk things.
I shout a lot when I'm playing Dota, but like, there's nothing like the like. I'm used to shouting like words, but in terms of like noiseless vocalization,
just vowel sounds,
like groups of people on Skype going it's great.
How do you guys feel about pillars? Are they good or bad?
Are they structurally necessary?
Well, yeah, they last for a long time, apparently.
We're
talking about Pillars of Eternity, which is an RPG, I think. Can't remember.
This isn't your vote, then.
No.
This is me and Tom, I think.
Yeah, this is this year's best RPG.
Yeah.
That's a pretty controversial statement.
Wow, yeah.
The Tom will now go outside to face the entire Witcher community.
They know what I look like now, so I'm fucked. But... it's. I was expecting it to be nostalgic fluff, to be frank, because it's harking back to the old Baldur's Gate games and the old kind of top-down view, and you've got a little party, and you know, there's some very slow scrolling text, and then an incredibly esoteric and complicated combat system happens, and it kind of still has all that stuff in it, but it is beautiful, and the combat itself is far better explained than it ever was, and actually streamlined, because they're not tied to Dungeons & Dragons anymore. Mm. They've developed their own system for a video game from the ground up, and that means that, you know, it just gets rid of loads of the dice-rolling bullshit that people used to arbitrarily put in those games in order to kind of be faithful to the D&D license. Mm. So what you end up with is like a load of interesting classes that overlap each other in interesting ways, and an interesting kind of tactical positioning game, a real-time pause positioning game about, you know, you have tanks that can block areas, and you have wizards that can fling from the back, and you've got bards who literally playing like...
I just love the phrase, wizards fling from the back.
Yeah, that's what they do.
I think if I was writing a song for Kesha, that's what it
would be. Possible podcast title.
Yeah.
You've got like bards who, you're arranging musical passages. That's how you make their spells. You kind of swap bars in and change them around and stuff. And that becomes, there's a kind of rhythm to the song where the first part of the song will be like a healy part of the song. Mm. Everyone feels healed and happy. Then there's the angry part of the song.
And then there's the summon skeletons part of the song.
Yeah, that's when shit gets really strange.
Is it Kesha always includes one of those?
Yes, that's the drop. Yeah, it's the skeleton drop. Yeah.
I think there's a song that causes fear.
Mm.
I wonder if you could do that lesser and greater variant, so you could have like spooky, then scary, then skeletons as a anyway.
Good idea, Chris. Thanks.
That's just one class in the game, and even the kind of the tanky knight characters are really fun to equip, and they all look amazing and beautiful. I'm so used to combat in RPGs being bad. Just outright bad. Mm. It's the thing that you just get through in order to get to the cool bits of the game. But in Pillars, it's actually a completely worthwhile investment of your time, and is frequently interesting. Even if you're trying to stealth it and it goes wrong, then you always kind of I've come up with like a load of formations. You can make custom formations for your people, and then you know if I've been discovered, I immediately snap into the combat formation, then look for choke points like a doorway or something to stab my tanks in, so I get my wizards behind them, and then get the bear in around the side. You can get a bear. Bear,
they
under your
they don't fling from the back.
They don't.
They fling from the front.
Or the flanks if they're going to join you. Unexpected from the flanking bear. Just how combat actually means something, as well as there being an interesting kind of RPG behind it, an interesting world with all its bespoke lore.
Love the bespoke lore. I was going to highlight the lore, actually.
Yeah.
And I love lore. But it's really nice to have a game story, particularly for an RPG, that... I mean, obviously, it's not going to be the most inventive fiction in the world because it is going to be fantasy fiction, but it has enough going for it in ways that's sufficiently interesting to keep you engaged. A lot of really interesting characters. But also, it doesn't sort of... This is a weird thing to say, particularly as somebody who really loved Mass Effect and Dragon Age, but it doesn't lean on interpersonal drama. It's completely to carry the story, right? Mm. It's not all about your sort of close relationships, one or two characters. Basically, in order to you have the freedom to say, I don't want to party with you anymore, go away. Like, it doesn't really force you to take anyone with you. And for that reason, it has a feeling I didn't realize I'd missed from Baldur's Gate or from similar role-playing games, which is that kind of like you're role-playing with a GM, like there's sort of more voices in play and every story is its own little self-contained thing. Mm. And it feels more naturally episodic and like your companions can just come and go and so on. And that sort of enhanced as you build up your manor and your estate, which is sort of the centre of the game. And there's sort of a gentleness to that that makes it easier to dip in and out of. It's not sort of, which is maybe a strange thing to praise it for, but it's never like as intense as BioWare game, which over the years as they've got better at it, have become so overwhelmingly about personal relationships and moments where you have to choose, like, do you want to kiss this person or murder their dad? And like, that's your choice. Like, Pillars is mostly like going to the pub with friends you've known for ages and no one really particularly wants to talk about themselves, which is becoming more appealing to me as I get older.
It's great. It's another one of these games that's benefited enormously from Kickstarter because all of the stretch goals are brilliant. And because they've made so much money, those stretch goals are all worthwhile and have actually fleshed out into something that feels much more interesting, even in The Witcher 3 for me. As as Chris says, you can build up your manor and your manor house, and I believe that was a stretch goal. There's this huge, enormous, winding dungeon beneath your manor. That was a stretch goal as well. And also all of the backers.
Oh wait, you're talking manor as in large house?
Yeah.
I was building up your manor as in magic resource.
Manor as in, like, you know, good vocabulary and like please.
Big manor's house.
There should be a manor. That's very good. Should be a manor stuff. Yeah, that's another stretch goal. And there, a lot of the backers, like the past a certain point, you get to have a little story told about you. You become an NPC in the world, and because the gift of your character is that you can kind of see into their soul in some way.
Mm.
And you sell these characters that they stand apart because I think they're also dressed in more kind of fancy armor. I think the backers might have had the opportunity to design their own character, their NPC that actually went into the game.
They look like player characters, so that makes sense.
Which is amazing because you go into a bar and this is actually like more D&D than most D&D games get, because you see these NPCs are actually other people, as though they're forming adventuring parties of themselves. And then you can go up to them and you click on them, you kind of read their soul, and you get like three or four paragraphs of just nicely written fantasy text that has their own little short story for them. And because there's so much of that in the world, like they're everywhere because there's so many backers, it makes it feel so rich. They feel like everyone in every pub like has a story.
I think that's what I was gesturing at, with the kind of that feeling of it not being about single intense relationships, but about this kind of like much broader richness where everything you go there's a little story and it's up to loaded to fucking balls with vignettes, that game.
It is.
It's just
vignettes as fuck. It's amazing.
I like the idea that the Kickstarter backers must have received an email saying, thank you, Kickstarter backer, please type in your soul. Player's going to be able to read your soul. When
I can't believe
soul.
The players
just
wrote
those
vignettes. I think they just, the writing involved in that is extraordinary. Yeah. Like, there are other games with great writing on this list, but in terms of like just effort involved in making hundreds of things that are all individually good, even if it's just three paragraph short stories, but they're all different. Like, you know, one will be just like, you know, two beats of a pirate's life as they cling to a mast and attempt not to die in a storm, and another one will be like a courtesan poisoning a master or something, and it's just, you know, it's relentless.
Is this stuff you see through the soul?
Yeah, you basically, these two characters might be standing talking to each other in a pub, but when you click on them, you'll get text describing like one key moment from that character's life, like one defining moment from their life at any point. So the fiction does go all over the place. It's not like you find a boring one who's like, and then he stood in the pub and looked at
it. So is it like that they're talking to this other person but they're secretly thinking about that time they're a structure master?
I don't know. You have the power to like see people's essences, basically. So it's like, I don't know, maybe they somehow became themselves at that moment or something. So that's the point you see them. I don't know.
I think the great thing about Pillars and its world depth is a testament to the power of reading. And you have to do a lot of reading playing that game. But the fact that they don't have to animate, you know, set up animation rigs for every single story thing they want to tell, they can just have like they can just write it down in a few paragraphs, and the writer's skilled enough, then you get a sense of that. And they even use this to add detail that they couldn't otherwise show, given the view that you're in, because you're obviously in suspended top-down view, and it looks beautiful, but you're never going to see the carving of some alien language in the wall. So what they do is that you can click on a highlight, and it will give you these passages explaining, like, this is this carving, and you can interact with it. So it becomes a little kind of text adventure. that happens inside the world, just to kind of give extra, just really granular, small details to another thing.
So it also does that for character interactions as well. Like, it'll do novelistic sort of action descriptions. So it'll say a character looks at his feet when he talks or something. And that's represented in the game, but it allows them to do weirdly more convincing acting than you get if you have a cutscene that's animated, and that's just incredibly hard. So in terms of efficiency, it's much more efficient than getting mocap to... In, you know, unconvincingly have a guy like fidget while he's talking or something.
Yeah, and you can see, you just tell it's why people have just read loads and loads of fantasy fiction and just love it, fucking love it, and just there's a lot of passion in it. And I think it's just a fantastic RPG.
What's the bomb called? The God Hammer.
God.
One of the key points in the backstory that I really fucking love is that this false prophet, this isn't really a spoiler because it's the first part of the game stuff, this person who wandered out of the woods claiming to be a messenger of the old gods was killed by the God Hammer, and you find out fairly quickly that the God Hammer was just a really big bomb. And I love that fact. So it wasn't magic, they just blew him the fuck up.
The way you're talking about it sounds like another game on the list. When you say it's Fignet as fuck, that's 80 Days. Which is an incredibly well written game about travelling all over the world, in which you meet people for just brief moments of time, have little dalliances with them, maybe give them a little smooch.
They really are dalliances.
Yeah. And then move on. And it's wonderful for that. And it's wonderful also for a single relationship, which is your relationship with Phileas Fogg, because you've been passepartout. And it becomes, depending on how you want to play it, a game about kindness, about being nice to the man that you're with, and deciding whether you're going to give his moustache a lovely comb to calm him down and he's feeling a bit seasick, or whether you're going to go up and find some ladies to romance.
Even if he's an aloof and possibly psychopathic jerk. Like, he's really cold. He's just completely unmoved by everything.
But you can totally win his respect.
I had one moment where he, like, broke that facade briefly, and it was quite powerful because of that. This was just, like, my third playthrough, maybe. And on previous playthroughs, I think I maybe made it on all of them, but, you know, just, like, in more than 80 days, and then my last one was on PC, which was my first time on PC, and I've made it in less than 80 days. And the PC version is actually, like, really messed up for me. The art on it, the assets that they've used, are massively downscaled from what's on the iOS version, which is weird to me, because my phone is this big, and my PC is this big. And so, if you use the same assets, I would have noticed some small flaws in it, but I would have been fine with it. But when you downscale it for PC, that seems completely bizarre to me, and it's really rough. Like, the clouds are just super pixely and blurry, and it's like things are at different resolutions, that one resolution, the icons are at different resolution. That really bothered me at first, and I was almost not going to play it on PC, but having it on a big screen is actually a really big deal, because reading on my iPhone is not a pleasant experience at all. I don't have an iPad, so it's always been just iPhone or PC. And my playthrough on PC was probably the first one I really kind of enjoyed, and I kind of, it's a game about travel, and you go to different places and you encounter different things, and often the game element of it is quite separate from the story element of it, where you're trying to get around the world in 80 days. Don't know if that was clear, but let's make that clear. And the game element of it is just like, what's the fastest route? You know, what's the shortest time we can get to the furthest city, and what's the best, most efficient travel route? And then once you know that, sometimes that journey isn't leaving until the next day, and then you might want to explore the city because you've got time to. You wouldn't normally kind of like miss a journey to explore the city for narrative reasons. So then the narrative stuff kind of happens while you're waiting for the game stuff to start happening again. And for some reason, like on my phone, I got way more into the game side of it. Because reading itself was not pleasurable, and there's a lot of text to get through in the narrative side of it. I recognized the writing was good, but I was impatient to get through it. I was like, come on, come on, come on. I want to leave tomorrow because I need to sell this cool scarf I just got for like twice the price. And then I can pay extra to go further on our next journey, because you can sometimes bribe people to leave sooner. And so I was too engaged with the game stuff, and it conflicted with the narrative stuff. And then on PC, just it being on a bigger screen, it was nicer to read things, and I was more looking forward to getting to the next place to see what adventures I'd get into. And I was eager to go exploring and find out what Passepartout would encounter, and the stuff he does encounter, I really like him as a character. He has a very much personality of his own. Even when you get dialogue options, they're all of a kind, and he's very polite. He's very you always get an option to be like super respectful to people. You can always kind of just like whatever the person's excited about, you always have the option to say, oh my god, that's amazing, I can't believe that you've done that, or like you can be really admiring of everyone, and sometimes you can express like slightly offish opinions, but it kind of comes through that he's just a very respectful person. And
I think I said on the podcast before when we talked about it that to me is a kind of power fantasy. It's the power to be, no matter how stressful the situation you're in, you can just be unflappably polite and respectful to everyone.
Yeah. It's great.
And I found that the being nice to Fogg and not being nice is basically the difference between failure and victory. Because the first time I failed it horribly, so I went down through the Amazon, I think he caught some terrible disease and I was like laid up for 2 weeks and we were way over schedule, and I tweeted about it, and then Richard Cobbett tweeted back saying, no, you just gotta just leave, let that guy go, just don't comb his stuff, don't iron anything, don't, and just ignore him completely, he'll become, you know, pale and ill and drawn, but you'll get there on time, that's what you've got to,
you have one job, that's what
you do. You just gotta ride that pony into the dust to win his bet for him.
It's an interesting design thing, because most games they give you a health meter, but it's your health, whereas the health meter in 80 days is Fox, it's someone else's. And it's the Inco Studios, the people who make this, they talk about it in terms of it's the Walking Dead thing, where the reason Clementine will remember that works in that game is that it's a bit of parenting advice. It makes you feel responsible for this little girl, and that's why it doesn't work so well in Telltale's other games, is that you don't feel responsible for the person, because when an adult character, you get told they will remember that, you just think, okay, well, of course they fucking get, why wouldn't they remember it? What are the
adult human,
why, yeah. Grown up. And like Fogg is essentially a child that you have to look after.
Yeah,
but it means that all your decisions then become a form of role play. They become like, how are you treating this other person?
I love the way
you buy him coats as well, that's the whole point, right?
Yeah.
I love the way that choices are written in that game, because they're not like outright statements, they're kind of gestures in different directions, which kind of you buy into the gesture depending on what aspect of the fiction you want to uncover more of. So it'll be like, oh, do I want to know more about this guild or that guild, and it kind of feels collaborative, because like the bit of text you choose then becomes part of another sentence they've written for you. And I think that's a really beautiful kind of balance of power to it, where I never feel screwed over by a conversation option, because they're not really conversation options, they're just kind of doors that you open to different parts of the book.
Sometimes the options you're choosing aren't what action you're going to take, sometimes it's the outcome to an action that you didn't decide. You just get to decide what happened after Passport you did a thing.
But I got so much joy out of that, so many little moments of surprise from the way that those, you know, the story would turn on those moments.
It's amazing that that's not more jarring, because that's such a fundamental break from everything that game dialogue choices are normally. It's an absolute rule that, you know, you choose what your character says, obviously you don't choose what the outcome is, that would be mad. But it turns out if you do that, it's not that jarring, and also it's quite cool. Like
it's great.
Nice. Obviously, sometimes you can sort of tell, well, it sounds like this one goes badly, so let's choose the other one. But it doesn't come up that often. Like, most of the time, it's kind of, I just go with what feels right for my character and how the story's going.
It's worth saying that, like, if we're calling out pillars for sort of this extraordinary group writing effort, then 80 Days is an extraordinary individual writing effort. Like,
Meg James,
I was sure that's the surname. Like, but in terms of just, it's crazy that one person produced that
with some writing and editing by John Ingold, who's one of the founders of Inco Studios, who we've talked about on the podcast before, because he wrote Make It Good. That was what he did before he founded Inco with another guy, their tech guy.
That was the sort of PI text adventure. That was really good.
Cool. Well, not one person, good. But still.
But you know, mainly Meg, is the main writer.
Yeah.
Amazing.
That's really interesting. I knew that name from Inkle Studios, but I hadn't pieced it together with the game that I've talked about on this podcast before.
We may need to go a little bit faster. Cities Skylin, I've written here.
Cities Skyrim.
I can talk about that real quick.
Yes,
do it. I used to install SimCity 4 every year to still play it for a little bit, for like 2 weeks before I get bored of it again, put it away for another 12 months. But that game came out in 2004, and despite having had a sequel a couple of years ago, I was still doing it. Now I don't have to, because Cities Skylines has taken its place. It is just the best city management game that's out there, and it captures the things that I enjoyed most about SimCity games and the things that the most recent SimCity kind of abandoned, which are mostly stuff to do with traffic flow. Making efficient roads is the most satisfying thing in a city management game. It's not placing down a police station to cast an area of effect police spell to stop crime that you can't see.
Well, roads are what define the shape of a city together, really.
And City Skylines does such a great job of showing you all the cars on the road. You can see thousands and thousands of cars driving about, and if there is a traffic jam, you can really clearly see the cars tailing all the way back, and it's really satisfying to then work out, well, how do I break this flow? Where are these cars trying to get to, and how can I stop this bottleneck, and can I do it public transport and so forth? That's a really interesting challenge, and just by giving a lot of detail to that simulation and giving you large maps to play with, the other ways that they cut corners that SimCity from 2013 didn't don't actually matter. It's great.
I love that such a great game has come out of what's essentially kind of a cynical decision to make very quickly after this game had flopped, to make the game that people clearly obviously wanted in its place.
Do you think it's cynical, or do you think that's just passion? Almost.
I think it's passion, because it's made by Colossal Order, who previously developed two games, Cities in Motion and Sequel Cities in Motion 2, which were about all about traffic and public transport.
Did they make Cities XL as well in the previous Cities games?
No, those were made by a different studio and are total bullshit. And they went. the original Cities XL developers went bust like 6 months after that game came out.
Oh, wow.
And the rights and the code and the assets were bought by another company, who have continually re-released that game with very minor adjustments under new titles. Whereas they only did Cities in Motion and Cities in Motion 2, which was all about, it was essentially transport tycoons. You didn't build the cities, you built the railway network to pick up cargo and that sort of stuff. And they said they always wanted to make a city management game, but they didn't think there was any way that they would ever be allowed or have the money to do it. But after SimCity flopped, they went to Paradox and went,
could do that.
And they made it in Unity.
With a team of like seven people.
Jesus.
Unbelievable.
God. EA feels...
It's got to be. I mean, I feel sorry for the actual team on SimCity, because it feels like it's scuppered a lot by high level decisions.
I think
all of the team heads on SimCity quit within like 3 months of it coming out, which is never a great sign.
What about Hers Tory?
That was my favourite Tory of the year.
Hers Tory is fantastic. It's a detective game essentially, but it's so rare when you're covering games full time for a game to come in that. It feels like a new genre, feels like a new, just an entirely new way of interacting with the game. And especially brilliant is that it's so simple. It's simply a search bar and a big database of video clips. And with that and a one-on-one performance, like FMV games are back now because of
definitely the best full motion video game of 2015.
So
at like, least that, yeah.
FMV is it's always been like an awkward thing because it's sort of expensive to produce, but then it also ends up looking amateur a lot of the time. And this is, I feel like Sam Barlow has just found this like unique situation. Oh, hopefully not unique, but like a situation no one else has come up with before, where it makes sense to have one camera that doesn't need to be particularly good quality, focused on one person without necessarily good lighting in one room, and just that's all you need. And so it's easy to produce, and that covers the full scope of the game. I think it's a genius piece of scoping than anything. It's like it's so difficult.
Project management of the year.
Yeah, I know. It sounds like kind of dry, but that's so hard. That's so difficult. Yeah. That is the reason 90% of people fail at the game they're making, is because the idea they have might be good, but the scope of what it takes to make it is so difficult. And I'm not certainly not saying how it's always easy to make, but it's so efficient, like all of the effort that they put into it, I think, comes through completely in the final thing and adds so much to it. The interface of searching for clips by, you type in a word, if it comes up in the transcript of any of the clips, which are, anywhere between like 5 seconds to 2 minutes, then that clip will be included, but it'll only show you the first five chronologically and not by relevance or by any other metric, which means, because there's a series of interviews over a series of days, the more revealing stuff is towards the end. And so to see a clip towards the end, which will probably be more revealing as to the plot, you need to think of a term that not only comes up in that conversation, but has never come up before. So it's kind of, it's a really smart system for like encouraging a player to guess the revelations and say, you know, if you think this plot, the final twist is going to be X, then try searching for X, because if that really is the final twist, it's not going to be in the early clips, it's going to be in the late clips.
It's part of the fun of any detective fiction, is trying to work out who did it, which no detective game ever really simulates. Even if you're going through the process of trying to solve the crime because you are the detective, you're never encouraged to do the thing you do when you're watching Jonathan Creek of skipping ahead to the last 5 minutes and trying to work out how the fuck did this happen.
Yeah. I'm reading a book at the moment where called The Tokyo Zodiac Murders, where about 70% of the way through, it has I can't remember what it's called. But a chapter where the author talks directly to you and says, by now, you have read enough information to guess what the final solution is to this mystery. So I encourage you to stop here and just sit here and think about it for a while. And I almost did because it was quite engaging. And I had one little like clue as to like, I think this mystery, the answer to that is this. But I had no idea about anything else. And I didn't trust the book enough that the solution would be perfectly logical, so I kept reading. And then it comes up with another one. Like another chapter later, it's like, you should really stop now, because you've had all the information, then you've had a bunch of hints, so you should really stop and think about it. I still didn't.
It's always the character played by the most famous actor.
Exactly.
With her story, like, I think, again, talking about writing games, but like, just it is incredibly efficient, but in order to be a game about language and for an order that puzzle to work and for it to be a puzzle, also tells a story that lasts about the right amount of time regardless of the player and so on. That's an extraordinarily clever piece of writing, because when a player can search for any word, every single word that's used matters.
Yeah.
But because they are supposed to be off the cuff interviews with one character, everything that's said needs to sound natural, and that's like, that honestly is mind-boggling to me. I have a single criticism of that game, and that there is what I think is either a cheat code or an Easter egg in it that sort of spoils it, and I can totally get the temptation to put it in there. There's a phrase you can search for that is quite obvious, and if you search for it, you get one video. There's only one video in which that phrase shows up, even though it's quite obvious. And it kind of gives you all the things you need to know to immediately solve everything.
Yeah, I think Matt Castle hit that. And as a result, he kind of felt that he didn't really...
Yeah, so I hit it during a moment of, not weakness, because I was just like, I was running out of ideas and I'd gotten most of the story, but I was somewhere, some distance from getting to the end, maybe like 80% of the way there. And so I broke away from my logical series of searches and my own investigation and typed in something that I was like, I wonder if there's a result for this. Just as a joke, really, like almost me making fun of the game. And there is, and it bumps you ahead loads. And that, I think, is like, honestly, if there was a director's cut of her story, I would simply remove that one thing, because anyone who knows, I don't want to spoil it, because it really is but that's my only criticism, is because it's the one point where the script becomes slightly self-referential or sort of you know, sort of plays with the naturalisticness for me of that dialogue, and that extraordinary performance actually as well, which is also worth highlighting, is like, games don't usually get really, really, really good acting in them, but...
I ran it as a murder mystery for my family in France. I've always wanted to like show them the cool things I like about games, but there are so few games where the interface is good enough that I can actually get them to interact with it. And so for this, I still kind of ran it. I had it on my laptop and I just asked them, what do you want to search for? And obviously they will watch the clips. And we'd watch all the new ones that that came up, and it was so interesting watching them all go through it. So it was like four people, and to combine, obviously they had a lot more kind of brain power than I was working with, and I did. And so they got something super fast that I didn't get for, you know, hours later. But then other things, just really basic stuff about like sort of why it was done. And actually, even who did it, they were mistaken about for a very long time.
Did you get angry at them? You were saying, come on!
No. It was fascinating. I was frantically taking notes. I was writing down, like, I tried to write down every search they made, but I didn't manage to do that quite. But they got so fixated on little details that I didn't even care about, and they sort of even found out more than me about certain things. But there were these big fundamental things that, from their perspective, they didn't know why the person who did it, who they thought they did it. But they weren't that curious about that for some reason, or it didn't seem like a gap. They just like, oh, as long as they figured out how it was possible, then they were happy with that and just wanted to know more background and stuff. And I was sitting there knowing that it wasn't that person, it wasn't that reason. Well, they didn't have a reason at all. And I'm like, you should really think about what the reason is. And that was so interesting, because when I played it myself, I had this brilliantly structured thriller where it had, you know, twists and turns, and there was an early moment, a clip where it seemed massively revealing, and I wrote loads of notes about what it meant. And then half an hour later I came back and watched it again, and with new information that I had, everything that they said was inverted, and I realised everything I thought was significant, it was significant, but it meant something that was almost the opposite of what I thought it meant. And that was so good.
Yeah, it's amazing that they build so many twists into a thing that feels autonomous. It feels like you're pushing through it, but actually the bombs drop for most people at, you know, regular intervals.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's what you're supposed to do. How did you do that? Yeah.
No, it worked perfectly for me. The pace of it was a great story. I don't know that I like the writing in it or the acting in it as much as other people. I thought the writing was fine, but I thought it was pretty heavy on symbolism, like mirrors or what they call... And all this other stuff. I don't know. But as a kind of production and a kind of game and the execution of it, I thought it was great.
It's one of those games that like to see more. Knows what it is and is short. This is a lot.
When you were talking earlier about games.
Yeah, definitely.
Knew what they were doing.
Well, luckily this is also a really small, compact game that we won't have much to talk about. Kerbal Space Program.
It's kind of what I thought you were going to say, because it came out this year. Like, I think we've spoken about it enough time to kind of everyone knows what it is. It's brilliant, probably one of the best games ever made, I would argue, simply because there's nothing else like it. No other game manages to be as many different things that Kerbal Space Program manages to be. Like, it's a cool puzzle game, it's a great educational game, or if you're not doing think about it in terms of education, it's a great way of encountering real stuff in a way that makes them feel more real to you. You can't play that game and not come away more appreciative of how rocket science actually works and how space travel actually works.
And how fucking difficult it is.
And how fucking difficult it is.
Unlikely it is.
Yeah. It's also a cool building game where you just make contraptions and try and do stuff. So those are great internal rules which are based on something called physics that's really complicated. But you can create all kinds of cool stuff, and you can go on YouTube and be shamed by people who are better at it than you.
I mentioned a moment ago that I thought Invisible Ink was a triumph of early access, because I played the first code of it and didn't like it, and it came out at the end of it and it was good and I love it. Whereas with Kerbal Space Program, I played the first release that they put up maybe on the TechSource forums or something like that, where literally you could just build a little rocket from like 6 different parts, hold down a button and it would go up, and as far as I know there wasn't even orbit yet. And so you just go up and then fall down, maybe like 2012. Certainly, I still worked at PC Gamer at the time. And it was still a fucking great thing. The core of that game is so much fun. Like, it is a great physics toy before it is a simulation or a game. And then the fact that it's a great simulation and now a great game as well. Everyone should play Kerbal Space Program.
Yeah.
And that's,
I haven't played it yet. Maybe I should.
Yeah, you really should.
Yeah, you love it.
It feels like it almost shouldn't be a game of any one year, because it's obviously probably one of the best things to happen in games.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
There's just a couple of great management/simulation games this year, because Prison Architect also came out of Early Access, which is also a great game that I really like, but I feel like everyone should play Kerbal Space Program, and I feel like Prison Architect is a game about prisons.
Like, Kerbal is genuinely for everybody, which is, you can't say about any games, or if you can say it, it's kind of a cliche, but you can, like, I think the genius of that game, one of many things, is that even though it's this super serious simulation of spaceflight, it looks silly and cartoony, which isn't jarring. It's actually kind of essential, because it makes it okay to fail. And that game is about repeated failure in a way that NASA would never be allowed to do. You know what I mean? Like, that is its one leap of fantasy, really. It's not the slight edges they sand off actual astrophysics. It's the fact that everyone's having a brilliant time, even when they're being plowed into the sides of things or lost in space forever. There's only really one settlement on Kerbin. It's the spaceport, and if you blow that up, they probably deserve it. They were launching the rocket in the first place. You know, there's no sort of unfortunate moment when you accidentally launch a human analogue into a human settlement. You're always launching tiny green people who are just happy to be there to their death. And that's why it's good.
Heroes
of the Storm.
No one cares about that.
No.
Next.
I care a little bit about that game, although less and less as the months go on since I haven't played it.
Really?
Yeah, I haven't played it because Rich Stanton's computer reliably crashed every time he was playing it after a while. I think some kind of processor overheating issue. And so, because I only really like playing games with people I know, multiplayer games, I stopped playing it as well. And
that's a sad story.
Well, yeah, but it's also given me kind of more perspective on the kind of experience that I got from it. And I am keen to go back to it to a degree, but I don't. I think a lot of my love of it was purely addiction.
A lot of my love of it was actually Rich.
That's true as well. Yeah, I'd play any game with Rich. I'd go into the fires of hell. I wouldn't.
No,
the
don't do that.
I saw him Infernum with him. That'd be similar.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it is. It is. I still think it is a bit like Baby's First Dota, but that's fine. And I kind of think that as the months have progressed, it's kind of betrayed that in a way which, say, Rocket League hasn't. And I think more and more choices are made by the people who are making that game to push it more towards the pro scene or balance things more towards the pro scene. I'm sure they've got stats which contradict this in terms of the wins and losses, but in terms of my pure enjoyment of it and in terms of how parsable things are, I feel it's gotten further away from, you know, my scrubland, which I like and like to defend. But even that said, I still think it's done a lot of good for that genre in terms of creating, like, that and Smite, I think, obviously. Yeah. I don't know anything about Smite, but hearing you talk about it, I think those three games more than others have done a lot to show that there's more space in that genre than Dota occupies. Like, Dota occupies one pole of that, of the MOBA, and there are actually other experiences that you can have within it.
Mm. I think, yeah, like, I really respect HOTS. Like, I've been around the block with it, as people who've listened to this podcast a lot will know. Mm. I went through a period recently of playing a lot solo. I feel like now, and this is just testament to something else, like, my HOTS sort of solo time was me exercising a lot of my solo ranked Dota demons, because I hate playing Dota solo, because Dota is really complicated and really personal, and it sucks. Like, I played a game today and I played my fucking heart out. And I lost, and I genuinely did lose because of an asshole. An actual asshole. But HOTS, it feels like being a bigger kid in a smaller pond. And you can kind of, like, steer it a lot. Mm. And there's no visible MMR, but I went and sorted out from the HOTS logs tracking site that gives you an MMR. And it was like, your MMR's going up constantly. And I was like, thanks, HOTS logs. I feel good about myself. And so it was
that matchmaking rating?
Matchmaking rating, yeah. So it was like your...
Is the website actually called HOTS logs?
HOTS logs. HOTS logs. Get your HOTS logs here.
Yeah, there was a game called Mars Warlogs.
Mars Warlogs?
Yeah, Mars Warlogs.
It was shit, wasn't it?
Actually, yeah. I remember
piece of
it name,
kicking
though.
Its face off.
Anyway.
But yeah, so like... And maybe that plays into the Baby's First Dota thing that, like, I mean, but yeah, I think for me personally, no game is ever going to be as meaningful or lasting as the other place. But in itself, I think HOTS is a really intelligently designed game. And I think, having been to the HOTS panels at BlizzCon and stuff, I'm actually kind of excited about what's going to happen to it this year or next year, because they are completely reworking matchmaking again.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big thing. That really did, in the last months of playing HOTS, I think this is what actually stopped me playing HOTS in spite of Richard, you know, as a result of Richard's absence, rather than carrying on in spite of that, was that the matchmaking was just routinely fucking us, basically. And it was made worse that we weren't being matched with... We weren't able to play the pick-and-ban mode of the game. Because we were trying to, you know, group up with three people, and that was just forbidden for the last, like, 3 months I played it or something.
I think Blizzard are really good at building multiplayer games, maybe it goes without saying at this point, but they are actually good at it. Sometimes I forget that, I think, when I'm assessing their stuff. Like, they are genuinely talented at this stuff and at balancing it and recognising the problems in it. And I think HOTS has a future for that reason. And it is a clever game. Like, it's worth saying, on its own right, without simply being accessible Dota or the Dota that you can play with your friends.
I'm being disingenuous when I call it Baby's First Dota. I like the way
it's accessible. And I take that back now. I mean, that's League, so it's fine. that's a joke. Like, we've talked about this before, but like the way that game is designed to emphasize
collective strategy and map control above maybe above farming or resource gathering, or specifically, or at least resource gathering. You do gather resources, but it's always time based. It's always based on a particular time, and it's part of your overall strategy rather than all of your overall strategy.
Yeah.
And on individual fighting as well, is less important than when you decide to start moving your power around the map.
It's perhaps less statsy as well, because there are just fewer, there aren't that many items. You can't buy items in the game, so you don't have to account for the kind of modifiers that they provide. So you don't have to have all these numbers in your head all the time.
Yeah, there's this, and that's actually in some ways more sophisticated, because it makes the entire game about the things that are hardest to do in any of these games, which is make decisions. That game is about making decisions.
And get people to make the same decisions that you've just made.
Exactly. And like, whereas, you know, Dota, it's beautifully complicated at the highest level. It's the best game ever made. But at the level that most people play it, it can be a game where you don't make any decisions, because you load up a guide, you buy all the items that are in the guide, you try and kill people, and if you lose, it's everybody else's fault. Whereas HOTS doesn't ask you to make loads of those decisions, which makes it look simpler. But actually, what the decisions it's asking you to make is, well, you don't get to choose how to build, pick a powerful hero, or build overpowered items. It's about, when are you going to go, and where are you going to go, when you go somewhere.
When are you going to hit the skeletons?
When are you going to hit the skeletons? Downstairs. Exactly. Do you go downstairs to hit the skeletons straight away? Do you wait a little bit? Do you hit all the skeletons? Do you hit most of the skeletons? Do you hit any skeletons? Do you go upstairs and hit the bigger skeletons? And so on.
I don't know what the answer is.
It's basically chess.
And that's enough about HOTS. The other game that I want to talk about is Grow Home, which is a tiny little game made by Ubisoft Reflections about a robot who likes plants.
A tiny little game made by that tiny little company
Ubisoft.
That's... You're saying that in a mocking voice, but actually I think Ubisoft Reflections is the Liverpool studio of Ubisoft, and it seems
is that where Driver was made?
Yeah, that's where Driver San Francisco was made.
Driver San Francisco was fucking great.
I think it's in Liverpool. Anyway, it's in Britain. Maybe it's
Liverpool.
Liverpool, that's all the same.
I wasn't being mocking.
Well, no, I mean, but, you know, obviously it's not made by the vast amass that is Ubisoft.
Liverpool?
It's made by all Liverpudlians.
I made this.
And it has the kind of qualities of an indie game. And it's really impressive and brilliant that Ubisoft has been able to foster that kind of indie creativity within its monstrousness. And it is just this very small... Again, it's a small game that knows exactly what it is. You're just this robot which has a kind of cool physics-y kind of walking procedural. I don't know, it's not exactly animated. You kind of grab onto the landscape and yank yourself along by alternately using the triggers if you're using a gamepad. And it gives it a really kind of tactile feel. And a lot of the time you're clambering up stuff, because you grow these giant beanstalks and you clamber up the beanstalks and then you ride the beanstalks, which look quite phallic, into
that's
big,
why you like this.
Big glowing vaginas of rock, and then
you steer them, don't you, as you're riding?
Yeah, kind of. like you know, in at the end of
like Dune.
Yes, yeah, I was going to say Doctor Strangelove, but Dune is also a good
Dune's a better one.
Well, for people riding a big dick.
yeah,
and then having
Dr. Roloff.
And then having done that, your beanstalk grows even more, and it's just but it's just a really there's not I mean that's it
go on
like you know I mean there are other th- there are things to collect if you want to collect them, and there and collecting stuff allows you to grow yourself even further. And they're nice things just to drag around. It's a really tactile game, but mostly it's just this kind of physics sandbox with this very kind of simple goal that everything kind of pulls into. You know, there's nothing extraneous. There's no kind of flab to that game. And again, you know, like the same with Rocket League.
All muscle.
Or both of us. Yeah, your beanstalk is just all muscle. And you've got to admire that kind of thing. Stand back and admire its majesty.
I was going to take a moment here before you move on to the next game. At some point in the first half of this podcast...
Oh God, we might pass that, but go on.
Well, we'll find out. Marsh drew a penis.
That's not true. I drew two. But one of them, I was trying to pay attention to somebody.
Okay.
And so I drew really badly.
All right, so I don't know if anyone listening to this
will watch
this. Is familiar with like spot the ball style competitions in newspapers from a long time ago, where there'd be a picture of someone on a football pitch with the ball edited out and you'd have to guess where it was. Whoever emails questions at greatcrowbar.com with the most accurate timestamp for when Marsh drew the first penis in this episode of the podcast will get some kind of prize.
This is brilliant. This is like the moment in Tom's book where the authors stop the thing to ask, you know, do you know who the murderer was?
Yeah. You check it out. Case. Which one of us is dead?
By now, you have all the information you need to judge when Marsh drew the penis.
Yeah, it's not where he drew it, because that's obvious. It's when.
But we have no way of verifying this, because I don't remember when I drew it.
I do.
Okay.
I thought you were just assuming that at some point Marsh drew a penis. Like, it's a pretty safe bet that in any situation, Marsh has drawn a penis after within an hour.
Yeah, the prize might be a drawing of a penis.
This one was really malformed because I had to look like I was interested in what Chris was saying. It went all wonky. It looks like a candle now.
I can attest that Grow Home's animation is physics-based because I used a teleporter in Grow Home, which is a thing you unlock, and I came out of it with my head glued to the floor. So I was just kind of like spasming out like that with my elbows above my head. I was stuck like that for some minutes.
But that's fantastic. That's what's so good about the game.
It started as an experiment in physics animation. Grew from that. They were experimenting with physics animation systems, and then went, this is kind of fun.
You see just this wonderful flail of limbs that has all this momentum behind it. And, you know, I don't know, there's just something so pleasing about playing with something.
I genuinely wasn't being disingenuous or...
Genuinely disingenuous.
Or mocking before when I said about genius. That tiny company Ubisoft, because I think, you know, if we were to give an award to the best AAA publisher, I think it's Ubisoft. I think they make the most interesting games. From Rainbow Six Siege, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But just over the last few years, whether it's Rayman or From Dust or Grow Home or... Baby's first World War One game.
Yeah, also then Child of Light was
Child of Light. Yeah.
Interesting, not great, but kind of interesting. Yeah, and what was that World War Two game that
Baby's first World War
Two game? The Sad Dog and the Nasty War, or whatever.
Yeah,
Valley of Hearts.
I admire the fact that they made it. Should you want to talk about Rainbow Six now? We can skip ahead. There's no reason to do it in this particular order.
Sure, they made Rainbow Six.
What a game! You've played really Rainbow Six.
Yeah, I have now. I played it with you and Owen and Daniel last night.
Yeah, it's really dismaying that you are way better than me. I've been playing it loads.
The only skills I used, like, I don't know the maps at all, and I don't know the tools very well.
Yeah, don't rub it in.
So it's an attack-defense game, so there's always one team that's defending and one team that's attacking. And if the team that's defending, then, you know... hiding in a dark corner, lying down, and then just waiting the entire round. If anyone comes through, then you have the instant jump on them. It's not foolproof, but it's pretty reliable in a public game. Like, it will get you a kill.
Do you think so? Because I think that the way that that game's meta has evolved in the very short amount of time that we've been playing it is fascinating. Because originally, that was totally the case. Gesticulating angrily at you with a pencil. I'll put this down. But since in the games that we were playing last night, we started to see people faking out about where the, like, you've got, if the terrorists, although they're never terrorists, where the enemy team is holding the hostage. I mean, they would
suddenly, just
dispersed all over the map to make it really difficult for anybody to tell where the actual hostage was.
Because before you play as the attacking team, you drive around in little car, like remote control cars.
It's just so much fun. They jump.
It's amazing. They're like,
you're talking about the drones, right?
Yeah.
It's not like you go go-karting before.
They're not full-size cars. That'd be conspicuous at best. Tiny cars that are just really, they almost look like little cylinders, and they just roll around. You can jump upstairs and stuff, and the enemies, if they see you, they can shoot those things. But if your objective is like just find out where's the hostage being held or where's the critical bomb or whatever, and
I've dropped the critical bomb once.
There are multiple bombs, this is the critical one. And yeah, we had one round where we were scouting it out, and we just, like, usually it's like the first person who sees some barbed wire or an enemy is like, okay, they're in this area, and even if they shoot me right now, we know it's roughly there, and we won't necessarily get eyes on the hostage and have it marked on our HUD, but we all know it's upstairs above the bar. But we were having that with just everyone. Like, everyone said, I saw someone, let someone shot me, and then someone else shot the other guy, and they were just all over the place in different buildings. And we realized they'd in that setup phase, probably done some setup and then just ran away from the hostage and just gone all over the map, so that when we found them, we didn't, like, there's a guy here, but apparently that's not where they're set up. And that totally flummoxed us, and so we never got to the hostage and we lost. Then we tried to do it to them and it didn't work.
I did have some success of leaving everybody else around the hostage and going around and then backtracking around where the people coming in were and killing them by shooting them in the back bravely. But yeah,
I love those remote control cameras. They're really fast and nippy and fun to drive, and you can press space and they jump, which feels nice because you're in a remote control car. But they're great in terrorist hunt mode where you're playing against the AI, because the AI will shoot at them, but it takes them a little moment before they shoot, and so you can use it to like tease them and kind of kick them around a little bit. You can like troll them with this little remote control car that makes this quite high pitched kind of when it drives, and you just kind of sneak around a corner and go until they see you, and then you scoot away really quickly, and then they come out. I don't know. I think I feel like I'm role playing the little robot from Star Wars: The Force Awakens when I'm in that thing.
People will have seen that when by the time this comes out.
Oh God, what a weird
different world it's going to be.
But it's I talked about it I think last episode, Rainbow Six Siege, and like asymmetric games, but it's interesting to me that it's a game about attacking and defending, where it's a game about it's a game that's designed systems around camping. You know, if you're a defender, then you're supposed to camp, you're supposed to entrench, you're supposed to put up walls and stuff like that. But as you say, the meta of it's really interesting because the walls are also destructible. So if there is a particular camping spot, then people just learn at random, fire your shotgun through this wall, and you might hit a guy and kill him on the other side if he hasn't reinforced or if he's in that room or whatever. And so it's this interesting tug of war to and fro between learning how your enemy is actually playing that legitimizes camping as a tactic in a way that other attack defense games, even when camping was a totally valid and logical choice, players fucking hated it because it still felt unfair in some way, where it feels like Rainbow Six Siege has built systems that support it in a way that makes it part of the game more, which is super rad.
It's a cool, cool game.
From Ubisoft.
How do people feel about Gutav?
Gutav.
As opposed to Mugzv.
Mugzv and Gutav.
Otherwise known as Grand Theft Auto V.
I reviewed this. It's good. It's weird because it's... I gave it a high score, and I think it deserves a high score because it's an extraordinary technical achievement. There's so much going on in it. Multiplayer is brilliant. And I was hoping to know before we recorded this about whether or not I would make it into like my personal top three of the year, because I really, really don't like the single player. Like, it has good set pieces, it has some, you know, good missions taken objectively and so on, but like the tone of that world and its storytelling has gotten to the point where when it's actually good, or at least like adept in its execution of its ideas, it's like somebody who's super charismatic but definitely an asshole. Like, there's nothing really nice about it. It's sort of attractive because it's such a dickhead, but like, almost as if the game was a person, right? Like, it's sort of, there's an attractiveness to how much of a prick it is.
GTA is negging you.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it is. And because it swung so hard to that end of the spectrum, I think. Right? And
it's as far away from 80 days as it's possible.
it is as far from that. And
GTA days.
But it's also pretty far from GTA 4, weirdly.
Yeah.
Like, GTA 4 was like...
Imagine a GTA written by Meg Giant. Wouldn't that be the best GTA?
My God,
ever?
Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah.
Meg like, Giant should write all the games. Actually, if you want to talk about Metal Gear and Kojima being famous for kind of letting films guide what he wants to do narratively, like... Kojima at least has added this thick layer of Kojima to anything he's done. Right? There's some real kind of weirdness in there, and you know, bullshit magical mechanics that we were talking about earlier, and so on. Whereas Rockstar's narrative building is technically adept in every sense, from the performances, the actors they get, the way they capture those performances, the music they use to accompany it, the art, and so on, design the cutscenes, and so on. But soulless for me to such an extreme degree that like I really, really reacted badly to it. Like,
oh, it's interesting you say soulless, because I think it's got a soul. It's just not a nice one.
Yeah, maybe that's a better way of putting it. Like, it's
There's also a tiresomeness to it now. Like what was once kind of really punky and rebellious about like the DMA designs, Grand Theft Auto games, is now just stupid, right? It's like, oh, you know, there's an internet in it, but it's called twat.
Yeah,
right.
Like,
hey,
that's GTA humor.
The A is an at sign.
Yeah, of course, because it's like on the internet you have at signs, but that sounds like an app. If you've got two duck there.
The thing is that's funny when you see it as a texture. In a game, like, and it's just a texture, but now it has to be incorporated into a whole piece of world building.
This
and
is the thing.
It's like, oh,
like
okay.
Back when GTA didn't really have a story, and you were a mute protagonist, and people shouted at you, and you went and had fun. Having those sort of visual gags on the environment just took what would have just been backdrops and made them into part of the experience, and that was cool.
Mm.
Whereas now the whole thing is this rich cinematic thing, and so it's a story about just twats. But like, but with those visual gags in the background, it's discordant and crap, and it I think it is like, I think that's back to the drawing board bad about that game. But like, the last time I seriously spent some time on GTA Online wasn't doing the heists and stuff, although they're brilliant. It was a bunch of us met up on our bikes and motorbikes and cars. We found a clothes shop. We all bought and got changed into the most garish beach outfits we could put together, with like neon plastic shades and beach shorts and like massive flip flops and stuff. And then we all got on a seaplane, sat on the struts, and just glided down the beach, skimming other players as a giant like seaplane full of pudgy, pasty men in shit shorts and flip flops, and then we all fell into the sea at once.
Aww.
And it was beautiful. It's like, no other game can you do that. No other game can you make your own fun, much as cliche as that is, in precisely that way. Like, fuck it, we're gonna fuck around. We made a game where you chase each other around the roller coaster. One of you would sit on the roller coaster, and someone else would run ahead of them naked, and you have to try and get around the entire roller coaster course before the person in the car runs you over. Like, There's such depth and brilliance to the world they made for that game. The fact that I think they squandered it on that single player is almost moot. It's still brilliant.
We used to do these things in GTA 4.
Mm.
Yeah, we had
GTA 5's multiplayer is much more robust, and there's a persistent online mode where you can much more easily play with other players, whereas GTA 4 was games for Windows Live to fuck, and barely ever worked, even when we were just trying to get three or four people in the same office into a game together. But when it did, it was that sort of stuff. It was make your own games with helicopters and mopeds, and that stuff was great. But the reason I love GTA 5 is the city. It's just the world they've created. And I think the single player is, in my eyes, better than GTA 4's in terms of mission design and the fun you can have with the heist as you go along and the particular set pieces.
It's kind of mechanically iterated.
I think it's mechanically iterated.
I think a lot of tonal things aren't as not to my taste.
I felt like GTA 4 was like, my guy was sort of like amoral but not an active jerk for most of it, as far as I played. And then the cast was full of jerks. It was like jerks and idiots, like pathetic idiots or utter fucking and those are the two characters. And then GTA 5 were like, I'm the utter fucking in at least two of the three characters. And also everyone else is an utter fucking and it's just so fucking depressing.
It's
hated it.
That's the most C-words we've ever used in a Pokemon.
I find that much less though, because like, I know that Nico is at times, in certain cutscenes and certain situations, a sympathetic character, but I lose all sympathy with him because he does what the ask him to, and it's just a game about doing jobs for
the mechanics.
It's not a Christmas podcast.
And it's the same with Red Dead Redemption, which is why I gave up on that game eventually as well. It's so frustrating to just do those random jobs, whereas GTA 5, although the characters that you're playing as are less sympathetic, the people you're doing the jobs for and the actual jobs you're doing, I didn't find as egregious. Like, most
especially
of the
for yourself,
time,
for
it is. You should line up for no reason.
It still reaches that fever pitch of doing jobs for people who are screwing you over and knowing you're screwing you over, and the fact that you've killed millions of people up until this point doesn't give you pause to say,
like, it's got stuff like Nico.
It's got the torture sequence.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think you can maybe.
The torture sequence you could possibly excuse as Rockstar making some kind of meta commentary on the way that violence is used in those games and scandalizes people, despite the fact that it's impersonal a lot of the time. And then finally, they presented a scene that would really
really legitimise the kind of criticisms of being kind of violent porn.
Is that an excuse for it?
I don't think... It's a reason for it.
It seems like it always makes it worse.
I gave up on GTA 4's missions at the point where you completely destroyed your cousin's life, and when he was in tears, you mocked him for it. Like, that didn't seem like a sympathetic character anymore. And I'd kind of given up on caring before that, when in like the sixth mission, your job is to get protection money from a bunch of businesses for some Russian asshole, and you just basically beat the crap out of and terrorize a bunch of recent immigrants who are poor and new to the country. And it's like, at that point, anything that GTA 4 is seeming to try to say about Nico Bellic just falls away. And so GTA 5's fantasy of just, this is, borderline Ocean's 11, but without so much of a sense of fun, like, we're just going to do bank heists because we want to be rich, that is much better to me than picking on the poor and the suffering. But before this movie goes on forever, the reason I was going to say I really like GTA 5 is just the city. I really like just walking around that world, and literally just walking around, especially now it's got first person mode on PC, and I spend much more of my time taking pictures with the crappily satirical Instagram clone on my in-game phone.
Instaballs or something.
Instages.
Yeah, that's a good joke.
I spend much more time taking photos of sunset and strange animations in parks that are just created for that one area of the world, or interesting looking streets. Yeah. It is a wonderfully convincing city to explore, much more so than any other game. And, I kind of value GTA for its systems to a certain extent as well, because although its in-game internet is called Twat, there is a very similitude to that world, which I value. Like, compare GTA to something like MGS5. GTA seems to have almost a surprising lack of systems. Like, it doesn't have any kind of the resources that you're normally collecting in an equivalent Ubisoft game. It doesn't have...
Yeah, the AI is non-existent, really. Like,
You don't feel like you're cleaning a map of icons. You don't feel like there's 200 collectibles to pick up at every corner. It doesn't feel like there's six different resources that each have a different thing, and that those are sub-goals, and every mission you perform is like, no, there's money, which you get for completing missions. And then everything else is just in service and building this world, whether it's the internet, whether it's the TV shows you can watch in your apartment, whether it's the sports that you can go play, the tennis game, the golf game, that sort of stuff. None of these things are particularly good in and of themselves, but they build a world which I find believable and extremely satisfying to just walk around. In a way that, even though I don't want to play their quite shitty tennis game, I wouldn't enjoy walking around that world as much if I didn't know that the tennis game was possible. That's the weird thing.
I think they should absolutely be applauded for the crazy depth and breadth of that thing. I just don't like any of the characters in it.
Yeah, I don't like the characters, but I don't know that that's necessarily an impediment to enjoying the game. I think even though I played it in 2014 on presumably on a console, I can't remember which, but it gave me one of my favourite moments of that year, which is, and as part of the narrative, as part of the single player as well, which was a psychedelic skydiving scene.
Oh yeah, I remember, yeah.
And it's just you skydiving, and it's trippy, and there's music playing, and yet I think maybe because of the contrast between that and where it takes place within the narrative, and it's kind of a cathartic moment for the character who's been an asshole up until now, maybe he realises at this point he should be slightly less of an asshole, give or take, it's such a moment of catharsis, and it's in such great contrast to the rest of the tone of the rest of the game, but I found it extremely kind of beautiful, really, which is weird.
Single tear coming down your face as you watch a middle-aged man continue to have a middle-aged crisis.
Yes. On drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But to what extent do games owe you nice characters?
You know, it's not about nice characters, it's about good characters, and I think that's the difference. Like, it's not that people in GTA, the problem with GTA 5, not to go make this last forever, but the problem with GTA 5 isn't that the characters are bad people, it's that everybody is, well, only the main characters are given any kind of depth, and they're given the kind of like self-indulgent depth of being an asshole, which is kind of the mark of really kind of tiresome anti-hero writing to me. Like, that kind of, well, they've got all these issues, so therefore it's justified that they're going through all this shit. And the characters that Michael particularly is surrounded by are all incredibly vapid, very immediate stereotypes that justify his crisis. You know, the notion is his midlife crisis isn't just a fucking psychotic break by a man who really has it good and shouldn't, maybe should calm the fuck down. And the way his wife is written, his daughter, his son is written, his wife's yoga instructor is written, all those characters are presented in the, probably the first stereotype you'd go to for each of those characters in order to justify the behavior of the twat at the center of it.
Well, you know why they're all terrible assholes? It's because there was such a strong pushback to Nico not being a terrible arsehole and that being dissonant, and not only that, but also bringing
to drink.
I didn't say the entire phrase, but also the fact that the game, you know, there were a lot of complaints when GTA 4 came out about it just not being the kind of fun thrill ride. It didn't have a jetpack in it, you know.
It wasn't zany enough.
And I think that's what Rockstar are doing with that torture scene. Is saying, well, okay, it's like saying, well, oh, you want pure carnage? You want just complete, you know, just amoral wish fulfillment? Well, here's what that looks like, you know. Maybe you shouldn't.
You don't get to absolve responsibility for something that you're doing in the game.
No, I'm not saying this really comes off well, but I can kind of understand the point that they're making.
There's a distinction, I think, between...
I hated it.
The self-absorption of the characters to which you're referring and its depiction of all other characters suggesting a certain self-absorption of the people making it. Yeah. And I don't think that's their intent. I don't think the people making it are self-absorbed. I think perhaps they're trying to create a world which reflects the worldview, like it's seen through the lens of the characters that are at the core of it. But it doesn't work. Like, the self-absorption of the three main characters should make them figures of ridicule that the game should then undercut. Like, you should be invested in their idiocy and awfulness, and then the world should prove them wrong. And yet the way it depicts all women... It suggests that it's trying to prove them right. Like, the writers of it seem to be bending the world to the whims of its characters.
It's tricky when you have three characters instead of one, in the way that you're not occupying one perspective, and therefore it's not a lens then, it's kind of this other thing. I do think it is supposed to be a game about fucked up masculinity. Like, masculinity at its extremes.
But they're not critical of masculinity.
But they're also have this conflict where it also has to be a power trip for the player. So what they do on the one hand is create these kind of disgusting characters who are obviously disgusting, but then they have to reinforce, give you pleasure as a player and give you awesome set pieces to do and make you an action hero. And those two things don't go together well if you're actually trying to say anything about, you know, that subject.
And it's just savage about femininity, whether it, you know, in all the cases, whether it's Michael's family or whether it's, is it Franklin's aunt that he stays with and her group of friends?
Or Trevor's introduction in its entirety.
Yeah.
Which explicitly includes one of the very few really good female characters that Grand Theft Auto game has had. Because his introduction includes lots of characters from Lost and Damned, which was probably the closest to Grand Theft Auto game has been to being about good people. And,
it's the Battle of the Gay Tony.
Well, Battle of the Gay, it's in the same era, right? Blair.
We should move on.
Yeah.
And with that Blair, we should move on to Blablon.
Blablon.
Bloodborne, which is
we're
not allowed to talk about it, so we definitely won't talk about it at all, will we, Tom?
And except that it's the best game of the year.
I haven't really played, and I really loved what I played, but I just haven't been able to play enough of it.
I went back I beat it all, and then I restarted on New Game Plus to do the expansion stuff, and that just merely reconfirmed the fact that it is in fact the best game of the year, and it's fucking unbelievably good.
I died to the first enemy 6 times and then gave up.
That's pretty good.
Fuck that game.
It's so good.
I don't. It's like Tekken Tom.
Yeah, it's Yeah, it does need its own podcastry, so I won't get into it now. Like, why it's
maybe we did promise once upon a time to do a Bloodborne on podcast.
But now is not the time.
No, it's not exactly the time. I'm not going to insert that second podcast into this already burgeoning podcast that we've created.
I want to talk briefly about the Beginner's Guide, which I think is, again, one of the small games of the year that knows exactly what it is. Very fine game, which is critical about the way that games are absorbed by their audience. And it's really interesting. I think it's such a perfect companion to Dr. Langoskov
and the Whirlwind Tiger, the terribly cursed emeralds, a whirlwind heist.
That's the one.
Podcast voice live, everybody.
Both of which were made by former makers of the Stanley Parable. But whereas the Beginner's Guide is kind of about the impossibility of knowing exactly what an author's intention are, Dr. Langoskov is obviously about the impossibility of really knowing what a player is ever going to do and desperately trying to account for that. And yet, you know, Dr. Langoskov does a really good job of accounting for everything the player might want to do. And it's a really interesting kind of battle of theses between those two games, almost. It's interesting to read the reactions to Beginner's Guide, which is kind of about... It's a fictional narrative delivered as though it were a kind of pseudo-documentary from the perspective of a fan of a particular maker's games, and he's showing you these people's games in modified versions of them so that he can take you through them as the player. Like a developer's commentary. And that kind of allows for him to not only explain the games and show you interesting things to do with games, but also expose his own weaknesses and his inability to understand them properly, and maybe the conflict between him and the developer of the games. And that plays out in a really kind of interesting way. I think it's probably one of the most profound games of the year in terms of it describing the parameters of authorial intent and reception of any kind of ideas, and death of the author, the validity of the audience's perspective irrespective of the original design, all these kind of massive ideas. And it's just so eloquent and kind of cool. I have problems with it as well, but I couldn't really talk about it. That's boring.
The only downside for me was that I actually believed it was real when it started. So it's Davey Reedon, the creator of Stanley Parable, who is, introduced himself as Davey Reedon, and he talks over a Counter-Strike map. I think Counter-Strike 1 rather than Counter-Strike Source, as you're walking around it, made by this esoteric creator. And for the first few levels going through this, I thought, this is like one of the coolest works of games journalism I've ever seen. Because he's made a sort of, he's used game making to develop a way of exploring one particular creator's work. And I had no context for it at all. It was just a thing that just arrived in my Steam account as an early test version. And so I had no idea what to make of it at all. I didn't have any context for whether it was a work of fiction or not. And so for a while, I just thought it was true. And I ended up enjoying it as a work of fiction, but for the time that I thought it was a work of fact, I thought, God, this is awesome. So of course you should explore other people's work like this, like making a game out of it and talking, doing an interactive narrative on it where, we have developers' commentary from the developers of the games, but we've never had developers' commentary from somewhere else. We've had a critic's commentary on developers' work.
No, I think it's a really good example of journalism that isn't journalism, but should be journalism. And I think actually...
A game journalism.
The way that the game problematises that is itself a kind of problem with the game.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Oh, Christ.
I was struck by it.
We have reached peak Creep and Crowbar. Peak drunkenness is actually part of it.
Yeah.
It did make me think more about the destructiveness of criticism. There are these prototypes that you can't possibly ever independently encounter yourself. You can't go and download those rooms, those games that exist in the Beginner's Guide separately. You can never form your own interpretation. You're forced through this guy's funnel interpretation in a way that actually destroys any potential for other interpretations of those rooms and those works.
Oh, there's one particular detail in the game which I can't explain, but it's a brilliant twist moment that's never actually kind of overtly highlighted by the narration or the context of the game. But if you spot it, and it kind of registers as something that's in contradiction with what you've learnt previously, and it just unlocks the entire thing.
That's such a vague explanation of something.
Sounds great. Enjoy that.
Enjoy that.
Is that, has anyone done a Let's Play of the Beginner's Guide? I asked because that sounds like it would be an amazing disaster.
That'd be hilarious.
I don't know.
I just really, really want to see PewDiePie or somebody like hoot over that. I think that would explain a lot to me.
Another indie game that I really didn't like, but you really did, Tom. Magic Circle.
Yeah, I wanted to include this one because I feel like a lot of people who would really love it maybe didn't play it. I feel like I was expecting it to be a big deal. I thought it would be like not quite Stanley Parable level, but sort of up there with it because it's very funny. It's got a premise.
You've been spoiled by being able to grimace.
On the audio version, it's always nice. Seen Marsh's grimace there. It's very much a similar space. It's about games. It's about the production of games, and it's about player choice and that kind of stuff. But the thing that I think is really valuable about it that you shouldn't miss if you're into the same kind of things I am is that it's an extraordinarily flexible playground for messing around with these incredible tools that it gives you. It's a game about you're in an unfinished game. There's AI creatures running around, and any of them you can stop them and edit them and change their behavior. So you get to edit their AI, and you get to edit who they're allied with, but you also get to edit really fundamental stuff like how they can move. Do they walk across the ground, or can they fly? How do they attack? Are they a melee creature, or do they have a long-range attack, or do they have a tractor beam, or do they take over the mind of what they're attacking, or do they copy their thoughts to all the other creatures of the same type? And you can mix and match all of these things and combine them in really creative ways. And I think its only flaw as a puzzle game is that it's so open-ended that there are, like, 17 solutions to every puzzle, to the point where the first one you think of will probably work. And so there are lots of things that you can just breeze through very easily. And I found the first half of it is that kind of puzzly stuff, and then the second half is less puzzly. And I was hoping that the second half would be just puzzly again, but harder, because the first half I'd solved these puzzles, like, with flying colours. I would solve them in, like, 7 ways simultaneously by creating this extraordinary army of mad freaks. All these properties you're adding to them are not just changing their behaviour, but they visually change them too. So if you say, I want this dog to fly, he sprouts helicopter blades and takes off into the air. If you say, I want this rock to attack with melee, he sprouts teeth. And the combinations of those things, I found myself just plugging different behaviours into different creatures just to see, like, okay, but how does the walker droid have a tractor beam? What does that look like? Or how does this turtle thing fly? What does that look like? And then creating these absurd mixture armies of that, programming them to sort of have particular hatreds for different things in the world, coax them out to attack those things, and then watching all the chaos unfold was so good.
And the thing is that, like, when we're playing it, you know, it takes a while until you actually get to start modifying behaviour, and I was like, as soon as that started happening, I was like, oh, there's the game.
Yeah.
I feel like it's kind of is dampened by the framework around it, and the kind of the things it's trying to say about games actually gets in the way of the amazing game that it probably should be. If they just made a game about that, it would have been...
I found the narrative a strange thing, because it's very story heavy, but the story is very sort of caricatured. It's these sort of the 3 or 4 archetypes of game developers, where one of them is just so far in the Richard Garriott direction, and one of them is so far in the pro gamer direction, and one of them is so far in the other one that they really ham it up. You know, they go all out to just the absolute extreme of those personalities, to the point where it feels like a comedy, except that then it has very emotionally charged moments, or moments of sort of critical emotional impact, and that felt at odds with the sort of tone of it. It would have been so happy that I wasn't taking it seriously, and then it was asking me to care about these things. I didn't really care that much, but luckily it has a great game at its core.
And the final game on this massive list, Keep Talking and Nobody Explodes,
which is the subtitle of every podcast we've ever made. Which is also the best co-op game, I think, probably released this year. It's a co-op game where one person is the bomb diffuser, and they are in a room with a bomb, and it's like Fisher Price. It's baby's first bomb. It's got, you know, it's got big countdown clocks on it, and big differently coloured wires, and big red buttons that say push on it. It looks tactile and lovely, like a bomb should look.
Well, it's designed to be a VR game, so you can actually rotate it in the VR version of the game, presumably with your weird paddle hands.
Whereas everyone else playing the game is, I don't know what to call it, they're not the diffuser, they've got a bomb manual. And the bomb manual is just a PDF And so it becomes a game about communication at that point. It's the bomb diffuser saying, okay, we've got wires, we've got a button that says push on it, we've got two batteries on the side, we've got a serial number, which is this, and it communicates all this stuff that the bomb manual readers then have to look up and then communicate back and forth. And it plays lovely with that idea. Plays lovely. For example, there's one
box
of the
quote there.
There's one of the puzzles is it brings up six buttons. Each of the buttons has a word in it on it, and the word might be C, spelled S E E, or it might be C, spelled S E A, or it might be C, just as in the letter C. And so it encourages these moments of panic and these moments where you develop your own language. Like, there's another one which is has a set of symbols. I think you talked about this in the podcast before, where it's it's the one that looks like a B, but you got bored halfway through. There's the curly pig's tail. There's the sort of
bottom of the triangle. Bottom of the triangle.
Yeah. It's the spider eye. You develop your own language, and then the way I always play it is that person who doesn't explode stays on, basically. Like, you keep playing until you explode, and then you start back at the beginning and everyone changes rounds.
I hear real bomb diffusers as well.
And then suddenly the person who's been looking at the manual, now they have to come up with a word for describing these symbols. And there's this moment in your brain at that point where you suddenly go, oh, that's what they meant when they said bum over a triangle. Or they don't do that, they just describe it in a completely different way without ever acknowledging that that's the symbol that you were looking at. You described over as a bum over a triangle, but they describe as a spider eye or whatever. And it becomes a co-op game about communication, but it's also a co-op game about learning to play the game. Mm. You know, it's best played if you've never looked at the manual before the point at which you start playing. It's best played if you're the diffuser for the first time and you've never seen the manual.
Do you think so?
Like, pure ignorance is the best way to play that game, because that's when you get the kind of maximum reliance on communication. Looking at the manual beforehand, whether you're going to be the diffuser or the manualer, spoils the experience somewhat, because you want to be learning about it in real time. It's a game about learning about new things in real time and then trying to communicate that to another person in real time. And it's a brilliant co-op game for that reason, and it's a brilliant party game for that reason. And I think it's a game that you could play with people who don't play games. Just give them a PDF and say, and it's all the puzzles are so perfectly pitched. Like, they're not complicated puzzles in themselves. Each individual puzzle is quite simple, actually, and it's quite quick, easily grokked. The challenge really is in the fact that you can't solve the puzzle. You have to tell someone else how to solve the puzzle. And then maybe you've got now six puzzles and a time limit of 3 minutes, and it's the Crystal Maze, and Richard O'Brien's making fun of you.
Do you tell the game how many players you're going to have, or do you still set the difficulty?
There's a progression of difficulty if you go through the game's challenges linearly, so you can...
And is it just easier if you have more players, because you have more people?
It's easier if you've got more players, because it is, then the communication... Extent. It becomes a larger problem now, because you're, as the bomb diffuser,
you're currently illustrating.
Now you're sorry.
No,
no, but now as the diffuser, you've got to talk to like five different people if you've just got more people reading the manual, so it doesn't become any easier. It becomes a project management challenge. Yeah, it's the 720 no scope. Well,
the pro video I saw of it, which I talked about before, was a guy with like four or five assistants, and they just had like a well oiled team, so he knew exactly to say, like, Dave, I need you to start looking at the symbol table, and then Lisa, can you look up the next thing like three steps before he was needed to solve
the problem?
But
that's not really easier. That's easier only because you've done the hard part of delegation.
Yeah, but I'm guessing because that was like a high level thing, he's, the reason they're playing with that many people is because it would be harder with fewer people.
Probably. I mean, there is as you play through it, the number of puzzles on each bomb increases. So, like, to begin with, it'll be three puzzles on a 5 minute bomb, and then pretty quickly you're on six puzzles on a 5 minute bomb, and then eight puzzles on a 3 minute bomb, and that sort of stuff. So, being able to delegate at that point But it is important, but it kind of outsources the main challenge away from the puzzles to the communication, so that even if you've got five people, when you're inexperienced, it doesn't make that much of a difference. Like, it works really well in that hardcore mode. Less, I think, because there's five people playing it or whatever, but just because they've played it so much that they have their own language. They've developed all those processes for, I'm going to tell you what puzzle is coming up, and then you and I are going to solve this puzzle right now while that other person is looking up the manual, and then this thing is going to unlock at every minute, and so I'm going to give that to this other person. Like, they've rehearsed that much that you become a kind of expert in it. Nice. That's really brilliant.
It seems like it has like a roots in disaster board games like Space Alert.
Oh yeah,
it's a lot like Space Alert, where it's very much about juggling 5 ± 2, which is like the short-term memory limit for humans, which is how these things are designed, where you're always juggling that amount of things at the same time, and you've normally got one commander who has to lay it one out for it to work.
Would you say also that it was a small game that knew exactly what it was?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
2015 review.
There it is. That's all you need.
Little games that knew exactly what they were, and also Metal Gear, Pillars of Eternity, and GTA 5.
It has no idea what it is.
Yeah. Keep Talking has an extra advantage in that it's a little game that knows exactly what it is and then made its title exactly what it is. It is literally Keep Talking and Nobody Explodes.
Hmm. No one mentioned The Witcher 3 very much, or Fallout 4.
I thought about Fallout 4, but like, it's not one of my games of the year. I sort of get the impression I probably like it more than anyone else.
I liked it, but it, as soon as I got to downtown Boston, it stopped working on my PC.
Yeah.
So I'm having to stop until I upgrade my PC.
And I haven't played it.
And I think it's a bit shit.
I'm not the biggest fan.
I haven't played The Witcher, so.
I like what I played of it a lot, but I didn't like the combat. And that was your sticking point as well, probably.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, The Witcher 3 has got stodgy things about it. Like, it looks fucking amazing, and the muddy, greasy, disgusting horror stories it tells in that world are really fascinating.
Lovely
as well.
Moments of writing and stuff. Really, yeah, and really nice quest design at certain points.
Really fantastic quest design. Not only like the Bloody Baron quest has been written about a lot, but even further on, there's an amazing quest for like a werewolf who you keep on killing. He keeps coming back, and he always just sounds strangled and frustrated with his lot every time you meet him. And it's funny, but also dark. And
best writing in a AAA game,
probably.
Yeah, for this year.
I'd go with that.
I watched a video on YouTube of a scene in which Geralt, with two of his buddies, gets really drunk, dresses up in drag, and then drunk dials using a magical portal device other scholars around the world.
Really?
Trying to call up his sorcerer's friends to come around and party with them, but he gets the incantation wrong because he's too drunk to remember it, and it just gets like a portal view of like some random person somewhere in a university elsewhere in the world who's really cross, and he's just there in drag dressed as like Yennefer.
There's a drunk quest in every Witcher game. There's a really good Geralt gets two wasted quests in The Witcher 2 as well, where he wakes up naked in the beach with a tattoo that's just permanently on your character. It's a third person game, you're always seeing it there. So there's an enormous quest to like, get rid of it. So if you're still on that quest, you're just stuck with it until you actually get the potions to get rid of it.
It starts with a drinking game you play with your two buddies. I've never done such and such, and if the other two people have done it, then they have to drink.
Yeah,
and so that's how it starts.
There's loads of The Witcher 2 is great actually,
but we don't like it that much. Well, so fuck that game. On the list. Marsh hasn't written in pencil. Why are we even talking about it?
It should be my exact thing. It's just that for reasons I've been talking about on this podcast and the previous podcast, for now almost 4 years, I never finished The Witcher 1.
Yeah.
And I just can't.
You don't want to do that, mate.
It's the Mass Effect that never quite...
Yeah, it is. It's
But it's which one's way worse than Mass Effect? Like, it has its defenders, but they're really wrong. Like, it's not a good game.
Literally trading card binders full of women.
Oh, well.
That's the entire list. So, all talked about all of the games for a lot of time, how much time? Lots of it? Just say lots.
1 hour and 59 minutes.
Jesus Christ. Okay, I don't think we have time for questions.
No.
Tom, Game of the Year.
Invisible Ink.
Tom Senior, Game of the Year.
Her Story.
Wow.
Marsh, Game of the Year.
Hearts.
You sound guilty about
that. I love how pained you look.
Yeah, I don't know.
Graham, Game of the Year.
Metal Gear Solid 5.
Yeah.
80 days.
Wow. Did not see Invis Blink. You did.
Yeah.
Yes. That's a good selection. No, that's an amazing selection.
I was going to say Invis Blink as well, but then I didn't. And that's how awards work.
But we all know that Bloodborne was the real winner.
Yeah, yeah. That's very true, actually. But that's for another
time. So, meaningless accolades dispensed. 2-hour mark reached. We're not going to have time for questions. This episode, for obvious reasons, we're going to... We can fold them into the next episode when we get back in
January.
Yeah.
Do you know when that'll be? Have we decided when that'll be?
No.
Yeah.
We'll decide when that'll be later. If you'd like to send us a question for a future episode, you can do so by emailing questions@creightoncrowbar.com or tweeting us at creightoncrowbar or by leaving a question on the forum at creightoncrowbar.com/forum. You can discuss this episode and future episodes. That's a nice one, Marty. That's bigger than the others.
Yeah.
Well, you can discuss this episode and future episodes. Future episodes? Can't discuss future episodes.
No, don't do that.
Confused by the dick. On our Discord channel, which is where people hang out now, which you can find a link for with an invite thing. Discord is like a chat program. Find the link on the sidebar of the website on the right-hand side. If you'd like to follow us as individuals on Twitter, I am at C Thurston. That's C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N. Graham, go the other way around.
I am at Gonas, G-O-N-N-A-S.
Marty.
I'm at Marsh Davis.
I'm at PCG Ludo, which is L-U-D-O.
I'm at Pentadact, P-E-N-T-A-D-A-C-T.
Merry Christmas. Smash. That's a good noise. We don't have any drink left.